So I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And somehow that makes me feel much more comfortable when I say that. I was reading an article on Piedmont Airlines coming up here today in the little Pace magazine, which is very interesting. And it was about adolescence. And this psychologist's position was that we remain in adolescence for two decades, from about age 10 until about age 30, before the whole thing passes. And I got thinking about that, and I was drunk until I was 30. And in my sobriety, I've had the unique experience of going through adolescence and the change of life at the same time. It's a trip, I'll tell you that. People say, how was your adolescence? I say, what adolescence? I don't know if I had any. I think I'm having it now. And it's just a trip. It's a joy. I've enjoyed every moment of it. I haven't had a drink since July 20th of 1965, and I'm terribly grateful for that. And and I appreciate that. I'm going to talk about a thing that's had very much to do with my own recovery process for the past several years, and that is this thing called detachment. Now, I'm not an expert on detachment, but it's very much an integral part of the path that I have tried to walk and still try to walk on a daily basis. And so it's important to me. And detachment is something I have found I get a chance to practice about every day. I got a chance to practice it today, too, because good old Piedmont lost my bag. Okay? And I had to kind of detach from that, and my first reaction was two words which I'm not going to say here. And the second thing was I knew I should have carried the thing on my shoulder when I got on the plane in the first place. And the third thing was my vanity. I'll have to get up there in my traveling clothes and talk to those people. And I went through all this, and then all of a sudden I realized, you're not going to die, Tom, if you don't receive your bag from Piedmont Airlines. It's not a life-threatening situation. And many times it's important for me to center or get centered by taking my attention from the problem and putting it on the solution, an idea which I find key to the process of detachment. And I had to do that this afternoon, and I need practice like that because I am not very good at that. I don't know if you folks know it, but those of us who are recovered alcoholics can become attached to many things. Especially do we become attached to those people in our lives who we love, our children, our wives, our friends. We become terribly attached to them. I often say to my ex-wife, who is a really fine Al-Anon, that I'm the world's worst enabler when it comes to my children. And I really do have to work on that. In order to cover this topic tonight, I'm going to use some personal experience, the experience of others. I have nothing to share with you, really, except my experience. And I'd like to talk first about attachment, and then detachment in the sense of why do we need to detach? What's it all about anyway? I want to give you some facts, as I see them, about detachment, give some illustrations of it. I know when I first came around the program, people were saying things that sounded very good to me, like turn it over, give it to God, let it go. And I didn't have nerve enough to ask in the beginning, how? How do you do that? It all sounds very good, and I wish I could do that, but would you please tell me how? And I'm going to try to get into some of the hows tonight. I want to cover some of the key principles which I feel are involved in detachment and some of the notions which I feel underlie it and present a need for it. And then try to give examples to show how it fits together in actual practice. Now, that's my plan. Whether I'll stick to that plan, I don't know. But I hope that we can learn something. It is not my purpose here tonight to, quote, educate you, end of quote, on the process of detachment. I don't know enough about it to do that. My purpose here tonight is hopefully to provoke you into some thinking about this, because I find it very, very, very important in any human life, especially in the lives of those that are touched by any form of addiction is detachment a very necessary proposition. Quite simply put, we get attached to people or things that are or do something for us and to us, which is very important. We get attached to people and things that do something to us or for us that is very important. And the things that they do to us or for us could be positive things, and they could be negative things. Both of them tend to present the problem of attachment. Most people, I believe, belong to the things and the people they're attached to. Most people, I believe, belong to the people and things that they're attached to. It's almost as if they were puppets, that many things, many important things, and many important people had strings attached to them. And when a string is pulled, they react. And another string is pulled, they react. Especially is this true if the important thing that has been done for you or to you is a negative one. I found this to be true for me. In other words, we get attached and we allow people to control us. We give away, if you will, our locus of control. And we need to detach, I think, to regain the control of our own lives. Because unless we do, we're puppets. We're tied by the strings of old feelings, old beliefs, old reaction patterns. And to be free, I feel we have to discover those strings, name them, and, if you will, cut them. So detachment gives us the opportunity to regain control of our own lives, to become free people by cutting the strings that hold us. We become, if you will, persons again instead of puppets. But we must set ourselves free. No one else can do it for us. Detachment, for me, has been a process, and I believe it is that for all people. It is not an event. I remember the times that I used to say, and I've heard it said so many times since, when the bender is over and the alcoholic or the addict says, "I've learned my lesson this time, I will never do it again." As if there were some form of magic, as if there were instant learning. Or I've heard myself and others say, "I used to resent so-and-so, but I've forgotten that." The detachment process does not come to fruition by forgetting things. I doubt if we ever forget anything. It's a healing process. It's an active process. It's something that I believe we have to do. And it's a spiritual process. And let me explain quickly what I mean by spiritual. When I mention the word spiritual, in some people's minds, I can see right away a picture. And it's of a steeple and pulpits and pews. And if you're a Southern Baptist like me, it's preaching on Sunday morning and Sunday night, and Monday night there's something, and Wednesday night there's something, and Thursday night there's something. And I do, by the way, suffer from two fatal illnesses. One of them is alcoholism, and the other is Southern Baptism. I was talking to someone tonight about my mom. God bless her. I have a love affair going with the lady, but we warred for years. Two very hard-headed people. And my mom will be 81 years old next week. And she's quite a lady. Very dominating kind of person. Very stubborn, very set in her ways. I refer to my mother as a black belt Southern Baptist. And when I talk about spirituality, I'm not talking about pulpits and steeples and pews. I'm not talking about Catholicism or Protestantism. I'm not talking about these things at all. When I talk about spirituality, I'm speaking to you of relationships, because I think those are core to all spirituality. And when I mention relationships and spirituality, right away, some people's minds go click, 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 G-O-D. And yes, that's very important. The relationship with a higher power or God of your own understanding or any kind of higher power, I think, is key to the spiritual way of life. But it leaves out so much. Because according to the spiritual teachers, there's another relationship. There's the vertical, but there's the horizontal. And the horizontal has to do with me and my brothers and my sisters. And according to them, the horizontal relationship takes precedence over the vertical relationship, and the vertical relationship won't come until the horizontal one is achieved. Okay. And so you got your vertical relationship, and you got your horizontal relationship, and in the intersection of those two things, that's it, where those two lines cross. And so when I'm talking spiritual, I mean relationships. And detachment has everything to do with relationships. Detachment takes time and it takes effort. Sometimes I wish it didn't, but it does. I've held resentments against people for years. I'm sure none of you have ever done that. That took a lot of time and effort. And it took me a lot of time and effort to realize that it was taking a lot of time and effort and flip over to the other side and put forth some positive time and effort and release myself, because I was the prisoner. Detachment can be painful. Perhaps that's the reason I avoided it in so many instances for so many years in so many cases. I do know it's central to all spiritual teaching. And I do know also that forgiveness is a crucial part of the process of detachment. So there's no magic. It doesn't happen all at once. It is a process. And it's a process of growth, very much a process of growth. Let me give you some illustrations of detachment. Any of you familiar with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? And the slogans that we have. These little life preservers, they call them. One of the slogans is, let go and let God. That's about detachment. That's all that it's about. It's about detachment. It's about detaching from the problem and turning for a solution. It is about letting go. I have a friend up in Toronto, Canada, and he's a very, very successful commercial artist and publicity person, PR person. And he shared with me a few years ago about himself and the problems he used to have with it. He has a very active mind. And he said, every time I would get a new account, the wheels would start turning. And I would generate all of these ideas that were all good for this account. And then he said, I did all the artwork done, everything done, and then the problem came, he said. I could not decide which one to use. And I would almost drive myself insane trying to figure out which of these many ideas was the best. And he said, you know what I do now? And I said, no. He said, I let it flow. I get everything down on paper, every idea, every gimmick that I can think of, all the artwork, everything done. And then I file them very carefully in my file cabinet. I lock the file cabinet and I leave the office. And he said, I might go play golf. I might go to a show. I might go out to dinner. I might do it for one day, I might do it for 5 or 7 days, but I don't return to the office, nor do I let my thoughts return to that file cabinet. And he said, maybe on the 9th tee in the backswing, there's the idea. And I go back to the office and I pull the one idea out of the file, and I've never missed yet. There's an actual example of letting go. Putting it in the file, turning your attention to something else, letting it work, and letting it come back to you. I like that story. I don't think I'll ever forget it. Another illustration of let go, let God. There's a friend of mine. He was one of my teachers in this way of life. His name was Chuck C. Some of you may be familiar with him, may be familiar with a lovely little book he wrote called A New Pair of Glasses. If you haven't seen that one, please give yourself a treat. And Chuck used to say when he had a problem, he would usually try to solve it. And when he was certain that the problem was going to drive him nuts, he would go into his closet. That's the way he put it. And he would say to the higher power, Father, I got this problem. And I'm really beating my brains out about it. And I really don't know what the answer is. But you do. And when you're ready to give it to me, I'd be much obliged. and he dropped the subject. That's an example of letting go. Another of the slogans that you hear, live and let live. I think that's the basic principle of good human relations. It's been very hard for me as a person, and I find it to be a hard thing for most people, to live and let live. I have this need to control. I'm a person who likes to be in control. Every relationship I ever had in my life, I was in control, or I got out of it. And I controlled in one of two ways. I either dominated the other person, or I depended on the other person. There's right field and left field for you. But either way, I had control. I'm still a person who does not like not being in control. And that's why detachment is so very important to me. And why it has been difficult for me to let go. Why it's been difficult for me to live and let live. To live and let live means to detach from the need to control. There's another slogan, one day at a time. I used to wonder about that one until I was reading my favorite philosopher, who happens to be Martin Buber, in the book I and Thou, and the following line jumped out and hit me. Now is the only point at which we touch eternity. Now, he said, is eternal. It is always now. I didn't wonder about one day at a time anymore. And what it means in terms of what we're talking about tonight is to detach from the past and the future. To live in the wonder of now. It's all there is. And when I'm living in the now, and those intersecting lines are in place, my life is just fantastic. I wish I could stay there all the time, but I can't. A good example, too, of all of these slogans rolled into one is a friend of mine up in Luray, Virginia. And his name is Julian. And Julian is one of those people who I believe has been sober longer than God, but he wasn't always that way. And Julian tells a story about when he first came in to the self-help group for sobriety. He heard these slogans, easy does it, let go and let God, and live and let live, and one day at a time, and he took them very seriously. He's a paint contractor, and he said he got up one day to go to work as a paint contractor, and he walked into the kitchen, and his wife met him with the news that the oil tank was leaking, and she couldn't get it stopped. The phone rang. It was a local hospital, and the doctor told him that his brother was in the hospital in DTs and was not expected to live. He goes out of the house. He goes to his first job. The man won't pay him his money because he didn't like the paint job that he'd done on the house. Absolutely refused. Really gave him a hard time. He got to the next job and learned that a couple of the painters had called in and said the bus was late. And he says, when painters call in and say the bus is late, they're drunk. So he gets in his truck and he drives back home and he walks through the kitchen. His wife says, where are you going? He said, I'm going back to bed. They told me to take it easy and to let go, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. And he went back to bed. And he slept, and he got up after a while, he said, and when the phone rang, it was the hospital. His brother was out of DTs and was going to live. And he walked in the kitchen. His wife said, by the way, said the washer on the oil tank swelled and it's not leaking anymore. The man who wouldn't pay him called and apologized and told him a check was on the way. And lo and behold, the two painters had missed a late bus. And he said, I've believed in this easy does it business ever since. And any time there's a problem in my life, I just go back to bed. Of course, Julian was also the one who said he went hunting for deer for 30 years and never got one. Go out in the woods and pass out, you know. He said, you thought at least one deer would have had the common decency to lay down beside me and die. There's some key principles that I think we need to know about detachment. And these come from the great spiritual teachers of mankind. They come from the likes of Lao Tzu, Moses, Buddha, Jesus. Anyone can increase the list. It's incredible how much they talked about the principle of detachment. Some of the things that the spiritual teachers said sounded like nonsense, because these men and women were purveyors of paradox. And they spoke in parables, and they said things that sounded like they couldn't be true, and lo and behold, they turned out to be true. And some of the old-time prophets, if you remember, were pretty strange people anyway. Live out in the desert and wore loincloths and ate grasshoppers and lived in a cave and ran into town every now and again and pounded the staff on the ground and said, "Thus saith the Lord." Now, I'd listen to somebody like that, wouldn't you? And some of their teachings really sound strange, almost crazy. And I've taken the position that either these men were the sanest and wisest who ever walked the face of the earth, and they were telling us the truth, or they were in fact insane and they were leading us astray. Paradox. The carpenter. If a soldier demands you carry his armor 1 mile, carry it 2. Why, that's nonsense, isn't it? If somebody strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other cheek. Now, to us macho men, that's really nonsense, isn't it? We just don't do that. As if somehow he were talking about the physical turning of the other cheek. And I do not believe that he was. Take it in context. In the days in which he spoke, if a Roman soldier demanded that you carry his armor for 1 mile, you carried his armor for 1 mile. The penalty for not doing so was death. And what he was saying is, the first mile, you have no choice. You are totally in that soldier's control. Ah, but if you say to him, "Sir, may I take it the 2nd mile? Then who's in control? Boy, that's heavy. It's almost so simple that we miss it. The turn the other cheek. Do you have people who know exactly what button to hit on you and when? Who can predict what your behavior is going to be in any situation and can cause it almost any time they want to? Suppose that person hits the button and tries to get out of you the predictable reaction. Suppose, in other words, the person smites you on the cheek and you smile and say, "Take your best shot. I'm not going to react the way that you want me to. You will no longer control my reactions." That makes profound sense to me. They emphasize these principles as central to all good human relationships. One of my favorite writers is a man named Emmett Fox. Some of you may have read some of his work. And I believe it was the Buddha who first said, "Reaction is the supreme art of life." Have to think about that. Reaction is the supreme art of life. Another man I heard say something one time I shall never forget. "It's not what happens to me in this life," he said, "that matters. It's my reaction to what happens that makes the total difference. Reaction is the supreme art of life. I gain, keep, or lose control based on my reaction to what happens to me." Some of these principles: resist not evil. You lose. I had a friend down in Texas, he's dead now, that I looked up to. The man was some kind of bigger than life person. He's the only man in the world that ever called me Sugar and got away with it. That was his name for me. And every time he saw me, he'd lift me off my feet in a big bear hug, hug me and kiss me on the cheek and say, "How you doing, Sugar?" And I loved it. I really loved it. You know, and I loved this man. And I learned so much from this man. It's funny who you learn spiritual things from. This was a Texas oil man that I learned from. And he said, "Tell me, Sugar," one day we were talking, "why is it every time I sit down to pray or do something that is holy, the first thing that comes into my mind when I close my eyes is a chorus line of naked women?" Y'all had things like that happen? You know? I know you have. I have. I said, Bob, I don't know. He said, you know, that used to really bother me. I'd say to myself, Bob, you're supposed to be doing something sacred and holy here, you see. And here's all these naked women running across your mind up here. And he said, I try to drive them away. You know, they were evil, and I try to drive them away. And he said, the harder I try to drive them away, the more of them started dancing across the stage. And he said, finally, the stage would be so full, I wouldn't pray. I'd say, to heck with this, and get up and go. I said, well, what do you do now? He said, well, they still come. And he said, I just let them dance across the stage of my mind from here to here, and when they're gone, I pray. Turn the other cheek, I mentioned. Here's a good one. Love your enemies. Do good to them who hurt you. Boy, that's weird. Isn't that strange? Another one. As a person thinks in his heart, so is he or she. All of the AA slogans are based on these. Every single one. Let me try to give you some examples of how these notions and these principles and everything fit together from my own life and from the lives of others. Maybe you can identify with some of this. One of the notions that I think is very important in the idea of a detachment is that I cannot choose what happens to me in this life. That's not up to me. I cannot choose what happens to me in this life. However, I can choose my reaction to it. I can't choose what happens to me, Mike, but I can choose my reaction to it. An example in my own life was my alcoholism. I certainly did not choose it. I did not want it. I did not like it. And my initial reaction, as it almost always is with any problem, is to glom in on it. And I fought, and I fought, and I fought. I went through Kubler Ross's 5 stages with alcoholism. Okay. I denied it. It made me terribly angry. I tried to bargain about it. I got terribly depressed about it. And finally, the magic. I accepted it. I'm an alcoholic. That's okay. Where'd I go from here? I chose to surrender to it. I had lost. I don't lose easily. I have told you before, I do not like not being in control. And the control issue is what kept me drinking much past the point where I knew I could not drink. I think Alcoholics Anonymous very aptly calls it self-will run riot. And I quit fighting. And I quit fighting when I was absolutely and totally whipped. And I mean that exactly like I say. When I realized I was going to die, I gave up. I have a beautiful saying in the Fellowship of NA. You might see some of the people wearing a t-shirt that says the following: the war is over. I surrendered. I won. There's a paradox for you. But it's the truth. It's the truth. Another notion. That to which I give my attention dominates my thinking and my behavior. That to which I give my attention dominates my thinking and behavior. In order to detach, I must redirect my attention. How many of you out there will honestly admit that when a problem comes into your life, you do like me and you jump on it with all force? Kind of really get totally involved in the problem. You know? Until I'm so involved in it, I can't separate myself from the problem or the problem from anything else, and it spreads and everything becomes a problem. When I was in the Air Force and I was in the early stages of my alcoholism, I was in Misawa, Japan. Anybody ever been to Misawa, Japan? I thought Japan was a very glamorous place, and they sent me to northern Japan where it snows 10 months out of the year. It's about as glamorous as Alaska. And I loved the little sake houses over there, and especially when I was broke. Because Japanese are very polite people, you know, and they take care of people who are down and out. And I'm in town one day, and I'm out of money, and I'm out of booze. I go in this little sake house, and I sit down, and there's this old papa-son in there, a grandfather type, beautiful little man. I'll never forget his face. And he was drinking sake, and naturally, politely, he offered me some. And they drink it in these beautiful little vase containers, you know, warm. I didn't care about the warmth. I wanted the effect. But Japanese, if you smile and let them know you're enjoying what you're imbibing, will give you more. I learned that one very quickly. It's the same way with food. When you're eating Japanese food, slurp a couple of times, and Mama-san will fill your bowl again. I learned that real quick. You've got to let them know you're enjoying it. So I was really enjoying that sake. And the more I enjoyed, the more he bought. And I really enjoyed that. And then he smiled and bowed, you know, and reached over on the counter and lifted out of a little dish what looked like a stick of chewing gum. And he gave it to me. And I smiled. He was buying, so I was eating whatever he was giving me, and I got chewing on that stuff. And I'd smile, you know, and smack my lips, you know, and stuff got bigger. And he handed me another piece. And the more I'd smile and let him know I was enjoying it, the more pieces he'd hand me out of that dish, you know, until it got to the point my jaws were like Dizzy Gillespie when he's blowing a high note on the trumpet, you know, just really extended out here. And I was chewing, and nothing was happening. It was just getting bigger. I found out later it was octopus, okay, dried octopus, which when you put the moisture back into it, kind of expands. I ran outside, spit it out, you know, went back in, and he wanted to give me more, so I kept on because he was still buying the sake. But that's an example. That's the way I do with problems many times, and that's the way I see many people do with their problems. They fill up with them. They chew them. The more they chew, the bigger the problem gets. The more they chew, the bigger the problem gets. Until they can't give any attention to anything else. When I was a young man, in high school, I was like a friend of mine. I majored in study hall, alcohol, and pool hall. Triple major. Very smart guy. I used to shoot pool at a little place called Doc's Pool Room in Raleigh, North Carolina, up on the second floor over Green's Restaurant. And Doc was a cute little man, and stood about this high, you know, and just a nice face and glasses, and he always had a straw hat on his head. I remember I used to wonder if he slept in that hat. You know, I never saw him without the hat. And I didn't come from an affluent family, and I liked to shoot pool, but didn't have any money. And I would go up and sit there, you know, and when the back table would be empty, Doc saw I had some talent for the game, and he started letting me shoot all I wanted to free on the back table. And he began to give me lessons, and he taught me, you know, how to draw the ball, and he taught me how to use English, and he taught me how to slow drag. And I got really good. And one day I remember Doc walked back there, and he says, come on, boy. Always call me boy. I want you to get in this game. Some local businessmen came in every day at lunchtime and shot pool for a lot of money. Until 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And he said to me, I want you to get in that game. My pockets were empty. I said, Doc, I can't get in that game. You're shooting for money. He said, I'm backing you, boy. He said, if you win, you keep it. If you lose, I'll take the loss. Now, you can't beat that deal. The little man had confidence, and I did very well. I had spending money all the time. I remember one time my mom sent my dad to get me out of the pool room because Southern Baptist kids are not supposed to be there. And Dad says, come on, son, let's go home. I said, Dad, I can't go. And he said, why? I said, it's money. He said, are you losing money? I said, no, sir, I'm $250 ahead. He said, I'll sit down and wait for you, son. One guy came in that pool room, and his name was Jeff. And any pool shooters out there, Jeff was one of those that reared back and just frammed the balls. You know, he didn't know where they were going. And he couldn't shoot a lick, you know? And I couldn't beat him. He was absolutely the best psychological pool player I've ever met in my life. You know, I slow dragged, right? And I had to concentrate. And he would stand in front of the pocket where I was going to shoot the ball, let his shadow fall right across my line of sight, and as I began my stroke, he would burp. Or something like that, you know. He did worse things than that, y'all. Or he'd reach back in his hip pocket and pull out that bottle of bourbon, cheap bourbon he always had in his hip pocket. And he's the only man I ever saw that sucked bourbon out of a bottle. He didn't swallow. He'd go, by the time you were stroking. God, I'd get furious. and I couldn't beat him. Doc watched all this happen. One day he takes me aside. He says, "Boy, you're not doing this right." I said, "That's obvious." He says, "You're giving Jeff all of your attention. Every bit of it. You're concentrating so much on him that you can't even control your own game." Now he said, "I'm going to tell you what to do. From now on, concentrate on your game. No matter what he does, concentrate on your game, and he will never beat you again." And he never did. What's more, I started doing the same things to him that he used to do to me. Just as he was stroking, I would burp. I'd let my shadow fall across his line. It got to be a game, a real game, you know. And he didn't want to shoot me anymore. And ironically, when I was sober was the next time I saw Jeff. Well, guess where I saw him? Same group I was going. He sucked too much bourbon out of that bottle for too long. That to which you give your attention dominates your thinking and behavior. I had to redirect my attention. And the principle there, of course, is turn the other cheek. Here's another one, another notion. Those for whom I hold strong negative or positive feelings own me and control me. Let that sink. Those for whom I hold strong negative or positive feelings own me and control me. You ever been so mad at somebody you could not get them off your mind? You could not do anything else to save your life. You could not sleep. You could not eat. You could not think of anything else. We all get obsessed. A friend of mine down in North Carolina told a story about a business associate he had some dealings with and got really angry at. Stormed home that night, went into his own home, slammed the door so hard he broke it. His wife, who was a sweet lady, met him and he jumped all over her. His daughter, high school age, he then jumped all over her. He went straight to his room, shut himself up in it, undressed, went to bed, could not sleep. At 3 o'clock in the morning, he realizes, "I have broken my door. I have hurt my wife and my daughter. I cannot sleep. I didn't eat any dinner. I'm laying here in the bed, rolling over and over, trying to sleep. And that so-and-so is laying across town sleeping like a baby." Who was attached? Before I got into this field, I was a college teacher. And I had a strange job for a college teacher. The president of the college thought very highly of my ability to do most anything. And my job, eventually, was when he would come up with one of his, I mean, wild ideas, he'd give it to me and I was going to make it work. That was the deal. I don't care what it was. I remember one day he walked into my office and he said, "Tom, I want a telephone system that people can call 24 hours a day and get messages on anything they want to have messages on, and I want it eventually to lead to people taking courses on the telephone, or at least parts of courses." And he turned and walked away. Within a year, I had a telephone system going 24 hours a day, getting 7,000 calls a week. But while I was carrying out this man's ideas, Mike, I couldn't spend much time at my desk. You see, I was all over the place, all over town, doing what he wanted me to do. And so my phone had to be answered. And I had made an enemy without knowing it of the lady who answered my phone. She had made an out-and-out pass at me one day, and I thought she was kidding, and I laughed at her. I learned that was a grave mistake later when I got thinking about it. I would tell her where I was going, where she could reach me, how long I'd be, who I'd be with, and when I'd be back. People would call me at the college and ask for me, and she would respond, "I haven't seen him today. I don't know where he is." And she had all the information right in front of me. She'd tell the president of the college, "I haven't seen him in 2 or 3 days, don't even know if he's working or not." She really had it in for me. Now, you know, that made me a little bit angry. And so I spoke with her reasonably. Don't ever try to talk reasonably with a resentful woman. Don't ever try to do that. She kept doing the same thing. I went to my boss and he talked with her. She kept doing the same things. And then I went to the one that we call sponsor. And these were even stranger than the spiritual teachers sometimes. And I told him what was happening. I was furious. I was screaming, weeping, really angry. And he said, "Well, you've got to go home and pray for her." Whoa. And you know what I said, don't you? Can't say it here. A lot of it, too. And he says, "You got to make it your business to do nice things for her every chance you get." I said, "You're nuts." And I went out of the house. Now, I had to psych myself up to go to work in the morning. I came home at night. I brought her with me. I couldn't think about anything else. And one night, I prayed the best I could do. The next morning, as I was backing out the driveway, going to work, I saw the roses blooming on the fence. And I stopped the car, went over, and picked 3 or 4 roses. And I go into work, and I walk over to her, and I said, "That's a nice suit you have on. You look very good today. Here, these roses are for you." And I turned and walked away. You should have seen her face. Then every time I would go out somewhere for coffee or something, I would, "Do you want some?" Within a matter of days, I was loose. I was free. She was bumfuzzled. She didn't know what was going on. Now, whether she's ever changed or not, I don't know. That's not my problem. All that I know was that I belonged to her, and only by releasing her could I be released. That's central to detachment. The idea that to forgive someone is for their good. Don't buy it. The principle there is, quite simply, love your enemy. Do good to them who hurt you. I never would have believed it without practice. Another one. That which I deeply believe about myself will manifest itself in my thinking and behavior. What I believe about me, I am going to be. I didn't know how deep this ran. I had some very strong beliefs about myself. You see, I'm a perfectionist. Perfectionists always fail. Any other perfectionist in here honest enough to admit it? You know, nothing is ever good enough for me. I used to think perfection would be removed from me if I asked, and not so. I was in my dentist's office last month, and I became aware that I was straightening up his magazines. Now, I'm not talking about putting them in neat little stacks. I'm talking about title, month, date, everything. And when I caught myself, it's second nature. When I caught myself, I scattered them back out and hoped nobody saw me. You see? And as a perfectionist, I never did anything good enough to suit me. Therefore, in my own mind, I was a failure at everything I ever did. And so when I was a very small boy, I had this sense of I'm a failure. I don't measure up. And through the years, with failure after failure after failure, and self-dislike upon self-dislike upon self-dislike, without knowing it at an unconscious level, I hated my guts. And my life showed it. Let things start going good in my life, I'd louse it up every time. Every time. And only self-examination brought out the fact of what I really believed about myself. I'm a loser. I'm a failure. I'm worthless. I'm unlovable. The people in my life I hurt the most were the people who tried to love me and the people I wanted to hurt the least. And I'd ask myself why. And I didn't know, because it was all down here. I had a lot of what Sid Simon calls vultures. Do you all have vultures, these self-put-downs that you do on yourself all the time? I used to think that would disappear too. It doesn't. These vultures are like old tapes. You do a certain thing and the old tape starts to play, and it's an automatic. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you could open up your internal tape player, take that tape out and replace it with a good one? Wouldn't it be wonderful too if you could erase that tape? I don't believe you can do this. I think what we have to do is put a new message over that old message on the tape. And we have to put it on there many, 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 many times until it covers the old and it becomes second nature to us. That's what I mean. It's a process, not an event. I'd been sober for a good long while. And people would say to me, "Tom, you're a nice guy, and we love you." And I would respond, "I'm glad you do, but I don't see why." Do you hear that? "I'm glad you think I'm doing a good job, but I don't see why you're saying that after all." And I never will forget the day I was sitting around on a Saturday morning with my best friend and his wife and their oldest daughter and my then wife, Donna. And they started in with telling Tom what a good guy he was. And it just flew all over me when people would do this. The story on me was, don't ask him for the shirt off your back. He'll give it to you. But don't you ever try to give him your shirt. He doesn't know how to take it. And they're laying on the applause. And I'm giving my typical response. And my friend says to me, "I'm getting damn sick and tired of you putting yourself down." And his wife said, "I am too." And his daughter said, "I am too." And my wife said, "And I am too." By this time, I'm up on the table. I have been confronted. I am not in control. And I said, "If I am so good, why don't you all take a positive inventory of me?" I was back in control and I slammed out the front door. They did. All four of them. A week later, they hand me a stack of papers about me and said, "Go read them now." Well, like Janet's request, you know, "Get your ass up here." You know, that was the kind of the thing they were doing. And I did. I went in my den and I sat down and I remember I read them for a couple hours and I wept because it began to become conscious. Only what the other person had said made it become conscious in me. Only other people could draw out the poison of my own beliefs about myself because I was not conscious of it. Did some funny things. In my quiet time in the morning, any self-haters in here? You don't have to raise your hand. In my quiet time in the morning, I made it my business to, in my own mind, pick out good things about me and repeat them to myself as a mantra. And all I could come up with was I was neat and punctual. That's all. Honest. So I go to my sponsor and I say, "What do I do?" He said, "What kind of person would you like to be?" Yeah, "Well, so and so." He said, "Write down the characteristics of the man that you want to be." I made a list. And he said, "Don't make it too long. Just a few things." I put the list on the back of my bedroom door. Every morning, I would look at number one. Maybe it was kindness. And I went out that day and did everything in my power to be a kind person. What he was telling me, what you want to be it. Don't wish it. Don't expect magic. Be what you want to be. And when number one seemed like it was, you know, going along pretty well, I'd move to number two. I had a ball. I had a ball being the kind of person I had always wanted to be. God, what an awakening. My kids say to me now, "You're the finest father in the whole world." And my response is, "Ain't that the damn truth?" But underneath and inside and quietly, silently, there is a thank you. And I'm not thanking only God. I'm thanking those who made me aware of what I was not aware of. Living proof, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. As a woman thinks in her heart, so is she. The heart thinking has to be changed. Detaching from the old beliefs. Discovering, discarding, replacing old beliefs. Practicing the new ones until they become the message on the tape rather than the old one. And I found another spiritual saying to be very helpful to me here. Deal with your adversary quickly. You ever notice how when a vulture comes, if you let him light and get his claws in, he brings all his friends with him? You ever notice that? I think that's what it means. When the vulture lights, say, "Hey, Mr. Vulture, I see you there. I do not want you on my tree." And replace the negative with a positive immediately. Immediately. That's important for me. I find myself washing dishes and I drop one and I break it and I hear myself say to me, "You sorry so-and-so, you've never done anything right." See, the old tape still plays. And I have to stop myself immediately and say, "Wait a minute. All you did was break a dish. Clean it up and do a good job. And when you do it, pat yourself on the back and then get on with your dishwashing. You're not so bad." There are some wonderful paths of detachment. Every spiritual path I can think of is a path of detachment. Every one. There's the Eightfold Middle Path of the Buddha. Do you know that one? It's beautiful. There's the Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain. Those are paths. There's the Ethical Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. That's a path. There's Tao, which literally means the way or the path. And Lao Tzu is one of my favorite people. He gave us an easy path to go. It sounds easy. It's very difficult. One of his students asked him at one point, "What is the highest motive in life?" And Lao Tzu replied, "To be like water." And the student looked at him with confusion, like some of you are looking at me with confusion right now about that statement. It doesn't seem to make sense again, does it? And the student asked, and reasonably so, "What do you mean the highest motive in life is to be like water? I'm being serious." And Lao Tzu said, "I'm being serious too." He said, "Water always knows where it's going. It's always flowing back to the source that it came from. It never loses its way. It doesn't fight anything or anybody. And yet in its flowing, it overcomes every single obstacle in its path. Therefore, my son, the highest motive in life is to be like water. To flow." Wouldn't you like to flow? Just flow through life. I think that's what detachment has as its goal. The ability to flow, to be, to freely be. But you want to be. And there's the 12-step path. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is shot through with the principle of detachment. That blue book says we must let go of old ideas, absolutely. And it means old feelings, old beliefs, old values, old fears. Much of the program is a process of detaching from those very things. I think the people who helped evolve the program, the 12-step program, which includes the spiritual teachers, by the way, in that evolutionary process, realized that if we changed our values and our beliefs and cleaned up our feelings, that our behavior would change. One of them actually said, "As within, so without." And I've said already, what you are inside will manifest itself in your behavior. Therefore, the 12 steps is an inner cleaning up process. As one of my friends says, freedom is an inside job. Steps 4 to 7. Deal especially with detachment from people you feel have wronged you in the past. with identification and the release of old reaction patterns and values and beliefs and feelings. Steps 8 and 9, for instance, call for the practice of a new reaction pattern. Step 10 is a mini self-contained process of detachment in and of itself. I want to look at some of those 12 steps as a process of detachment in a little more detailed manner, if you don't mind. Are you familiar with the 12 steps, most of you? Okay. Steps 1 to 3. Deal with detachment from the idea that I have any power whatsoever over alcohol. Or that I can, isolated, manage my own life. There is the we immediately in the first three steps. Immediately, the word we pops up. And to me, we is the basic word of the spiritual life. I is the basic word of addiction, I believe, and separation of any kind. And right away, we detach from the idea. Again, we surrender, we give up, and we win. Step 4, a written self-examination. How many of you in here, if I ask you to write down your top 5 values in your hierarchy, could do it? Are you like me? Maybe you'd write down what you wish they were or what you think they are. I think the best way to find out what my real values are and my real beliefs really are is to look at my behavior. And when I did that, didn't jibe with what I thought they were or what I wished they were at all. It began to become apparent to me only when I examined my past life and my past behavior and those feeling patterns and reaction patterns that I had lived through. Then I began to become aware of what my values really were. But once I became aware of them, then I could discard. I could change. Step 4 is really something. If you take it according to the process given in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it is really something. We're supposed to go back through our lives and list every person, idea, institution, thing that we resent. All of them. Why we resent them? What did they do to us? What was it important that they did to us or for us that has attached us to them, lo, these many years? What is the string? Identify. Once having written this, we are supposed to, in the words of the program, put out of our minds the wrongs that others have done. That is a long way of saying forgive the other people. Put out of your mind the wrongs that others have done and look for your own faults, your own mistakes. Forgiveness pops up big. And to forgive means to cease to resent. To stop resenting, to turn loose, to release, to remit, to let go. I used to think I had to like somebody if I was going to forgive them. I had to justify what they had done to me, and work up some kind of a liking for them. She's not such a bad old girl, you know, and I believe I can forgive her. And after all, what she did, she really didn't mean to do. But I wouldn't buy all that stuff. And no one ever said, and forgiveness is crucial to detachment, no one ever said, to my knowledge, that I have to like anyone in order to forgive them. Not once have I seen that idea. It was here. I have to somehow justify, work up a liking. No, I don't. No, I don't. Classic story. One of my closest friends in this recovery life is another Tom. And when Tom came into the program, he came in with his wife at the same time. And right away, his wife started running around with another man. And Tom used to come to meetings, true story, with a .38 pistol in his right-hand pocket and his left-hand pocket full of cartridges, looking for the man to kill him. In his car, there was a police special under the seat, and in the pocket of the car, another box of cartridges. He was twisted with anger. He never found the man. Thank God. He went to his sponsor and said, "What do I do?" Same response from this strange person. He said, "You have to pray for him." Tom just stormed out of the house. "I'll never do that." And he went on like I, carrying the load, carrying the pistols, had no bottoms at all in the pockets of his pants. And one night he could stand it no more. I'm going to give you the literal words of his prayer. Please don't be offended. It was the best he could do. He said, "I hadn't prayed in a long time. Only way I knew how to pray was get on my knees. And I got on my knees and I said it this way. Lord, if you are of a mind to bless that SOB, I will not object. Amen." True. He didn't like him at all, did he? He no longer carries the .38 or the cartridges. He divorced the lady. Not long ago, he ran into the man. They embraced. Tell me detachment doesn't work. Tell me forgiveness doesn't work. I'm sorry, I can't believe you. There was a time I would have. But you see, Tom was free. That's the point. When you free your enemy, you free yourself. Hatred does not cease with hatred. Freedom is a circular thing, as is action-reaction a circular thing. And the idea of karma plays very large in the self-examination in the 12 steps. Very large. Our troubles, we think, it says, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. We invariably find, as we look at our path, that we have done something based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. That's tough. And I found it is that way. Don't always like it, but it is. And for those of you unfamiliar with karma or the law of retribution, the simplest way to put it is it's like a wheel. You hear kids out on the street saying, "What goes around comes around." Wonder if they know they're talking about karma. It's like a wheel, and the law of karma is quite simply this. What I put on the wheel here is going to come back to me. Exactly what I put on it will come back. Maybe not today. Maybe not 2 years from now. But at some point in time, my seed will be reaped by me. Does not mean other people are not wrong. They are sometimes. But it means I get nowhere by looking at their wrong. I get everywhere by finding and getting rid of my own. Forgiveness is big. And then you come full circle. If you do this self-examination in the fourth step according to the directions, you've looked at other people's faults, you've dumped all your feelings about them on paper, you've released them through forgiveness, and now it says we resolutely look for our own faults. And when we saw these, we admitted them. And then, it's almost insult to injury, we made a list of the people we had hurt. That's full circle. That's a dynamite proposition. It's a beautiful proposition. It's a painful proposition. But the price of freedom sometimes is pain. I've learned the truth of what Emmett Fox said at one point. With a new difficulty of any kind, it is the reception I give it mentally and the attitude I take towards it in my own thought that totally determine its effect on me. With a new difficulty of any kind, it's the reception I give it mentally and the attitude I take towards it in my own thought that totally determine its effect on me. In the fifth step, you release the information you found in your writing to another person. You cut a string called distrust. Step 6 and 7, you get ready to let go of those old ideas. Your faults, value-based faults, belief-based faults, feeling-based faults, all these faults. And then you let them go. And you cut the strings of these old ideas. Steps 8 and 9, make restitution to others, even if they have harmed you. That's tough. It says we made direct amends. Many people think amends mean a mumbled apology. That is not what they mean. To amend means to repair or to attempt to make better. But you cut the strings of your old reactions. And the beauty of this is that wheel, which is so loaded with karmic material, we have an opportunity to clean it off. Yeah. Clean it off. And start new. And have what the spiritual teachers call a metanoia, a rebirth. Start out new. That's beautiful. Steps 1 through 9 in the 12-step process cut the strings of the past and bring us into the now. And then there's step 10. And step 10 says we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Very short and sweet step. And if you get into the directions, it says continue the process of steps 1 through 9. And it has very much to do with a practice called watching. Have you ever noticed how much spiritual teachers tell their followers to watch? I don't know what that meant. Watch. What does it mean? The Greek word for watch is gregorite. It means wake up. Be aware. Look around you. I recommend everyone who wants to practice the process of detachment or live the spiritual way of life, the practice of watching. And what is it? Have you ever taken a day or even a couple hours out of a day and watch for the good things that happen to you and for you that you don't have anything to do with? Try it. It'll blow you away. It is absolutely unbelievable when you take the time. The right word is spoken. The right letter comes. The right phone call comes. The right sunset's there. Just watch. And the other side of watching, take a couple hours or take a whole day if you really want to wake yourself up to what you feel about yourself, and watch for the number of times in a 24-hour period you put yourself down. And that's what the 10th step's all about to me. It's about watching. Watch. When you're wrong, admit it. When you're right, that's okay too. And probably the best part in this whole step, I have trouble with feelings. I cannot work through my feelings. Maybe some people can. I cannot handle my feelings. I got to get rid of those suckers. I have got to express them. And what it says in the 10th step, is when you have these heavy negative feelings, name them, own them, and then realize that the feeling is a reaction, yes, a response, yes, but more than anything else, feelings are energy.
use the energy. The most negative feeling is loaded with positive energy if it's turned in a positive direction. When you are angry, go help somebody. When you're afraid, be nice to somebody. It's really nonsense, isn't it? I told a kid one day in treatment center, he was loaded with fear. Said, do something nice for somebody. He said, what? I said, you don't have to save any souls. You're not capable of that, you know? Pat somebody on the back. Hug somebody's neck. Say hello to people. Smile. Be nice. Fill up coffee cups. I said, you can fill up coffee cups, can't you? And you see your friend's coffee cup half empty, fill up his cup. He said, you must not understand how frightened I am. I said, yes, I do. You're going to be one of the busiest people on the face of this earth. And he filled up coffee cups. So help me. True story. 3 days, he was not afraid like he had been afraid. He used the energy in a positive direction, the most negative. And, you know, we get a positive feeling. Man, we just glom it all over somebody. Yippee! But get a negative one, it's all energy. In and of itself, it's neither negative nor positive. It's what I do with it. And I learned that. And it's extremely difficult to practice. Step 11, suggests prayer and meditation. I think this is a process of retraining the unconscious, but I think it's also a process of cutting the strings of total ego control. Coming out from under the domination of what lives above your eyebrows and allowing some of your deeper self to express, if you will. And then the 12th step is practice what you've learned and teach it to others. In everything that you do, practice the principles of the program. One of the programs is, I hope I've pointed out to you, detachment. One of the primary principles of any good life well lived is, I believe, detachment. It has got to be. So I think the Buddha was right, and Jesus was right, and Moses was right, and Emmett Fox was right, and I feel comfortable in a church or a mosque or a synagogue. I feel comfortable sitting like Lao Tzu down by the brook playing in the mud, skipping rocks across the water, and I do not consider that wasted time. Valuable time. Detachment can give us the freedom to be ourselves. Only when we cut the strings that other people have attached to us and we've let them do it can we be free. How many of you would like your life to belong to the person that you dislike the most on the face of the earth? And often that is the case. To be totally detached, think about that. To own nothing or anybody. To belong to nothing and nobody. To have no strength is to be totally free. Kris Kristofferson said it. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. I hope you think about these things. Like I told you, I can't give you the encyclopedic version. I'm not that smart. But I do hope I've caused you to think a little about this principle of detachment and done a little to show you how vitally important it is in our lives, and especially in the lives of people who are addicted to a drug, an idea, a game, or a person. Central.